but bad and inappropriate jokes are jokes. Leo Tolstoy, in a famous essay he wrote on the nature of art, distinguishes between art and non-art on the one hand, and between good art and bad art on the other. Bad art is art. It's just bad at it. Bad and inappropriate jokes are jokes. They are jokes, and thus are humor. A joke does not have to be good or successful to qualify as a joke. But what makes a joke bad? That's a question of artistic judgment. And that brings us to our last question. Is funniness subjective? So, laughter is not subjective. It's an objective fact of the world, whether you laugh or not. Humor is not subjective. It's an objective fact of the world, whether an utterance is non-bona fide communication, that is a joke intended to inspire amusement and mirth, or a bona fide bit of communication designed to impart propositional belief. But what about our last concept, funniness? The answer is, as is so often the case in philosophy, it depends upon what you mean by funniness. If we take funniness to be a version of taste, similar to taste in food, then it is subjective. There are some jokes that I like as much as I love my wife's cooking. Interpret that as you will. And in both cases, it's a personal matter of internal experience. But what is interesting is that there is large-scale agreement about when a joke is funny. We all tend to laugh at pretty much the same things. When you go to a comedy show, you don't have people laughing at random times. They all laugh at the same point. And there's wide-ranging agreement on who and what is funny. We all have friends who are just absolute cut-ups, who get everyone rolling all the time. And then we have friends who could not tell a joke properly if their lives depended on it. It's not random who gets identified as funny and who doesn't. If funniness were completely subjective, then we would expect a normal distribution where there would be roughly the same percentages that would consider any given person funny. But that's not the case. We usually agree on who the funny ones are. And this is even more true for those who make their living being funny. There are masters of comedy who are clearly better at being funny than young up-and-comers or has-beens who never made it. Now, that doesn't mean that there are no hidden gems in the comedy world, great comedians that just didn't get a break. There are. But the point is that there are some comedians whose appeal is so broad that any explanation seems to include some objective elements of funniness. Perhaps the most important test in terms of the objectivity or subjectivity of funniness is the rational argument test. Could you change your mind about the funniness of a joke based on a rational argument? Are there reasons why you find something funny, or is it simply an experience internal to your mind? I must say that I'm of two minds on this question. There are certainly jokes whose incredible funniness I could account for. The structure, the cleverness, the word choice, the timing, these are elements that help make or break a joke. It seems like on this basis, rational arguments can be made for the objective funniness of a joke. You'll often hear comedians respond to an audience when a joke falls flat, say, "That joke was funnier than that." It doesn't seem to be an absurd thing to say. At the same time, there are some jokes I find rip-roaringly funny and, to be perfectly honest, I don't know why. They aren't particularly good jokes technically, they aren't well crafted, and some of them are just absolutely stupid. Yet just thinking of them makes me start to chuckle. I could never defend the artistic merits of these jokes if I had to, but for some unexplained reason, I just find them funny. So, laughter and humor are objective. But is funniness? Well, you be the philosopher. You tell me. I'm going to take the rest of the day off.
Lecture 3. The Science of Laughter.
So what's this one about?
Philosophy and science.
And I bet you have a joke for that, don't you?
Yes, I do. So, the dean is working on his budget. He's got his spreadsheets laid out, and he's pulling out his hair. He says, "Look at how much money the physicists are asking for. Why can't they be more like the mathematicians? all the mathematicians want is money for paper to write on, pencils to write with, and erasers for when they make mistakes. And the philosophers, they don't even ask for erasers.
I don't get it.
Maybe you're a philosopher. The purpose of this conversation is to examine what science can tell us about laughter. Laughter is a physiological effect, something that comes from the body in a certain situation. As such, if we want to understand it, we need to understand what we're told by several different sciences. Physiology, cognitive science, evolutionary biology, neuropsychology, and social psychology. Why devote an entire lecture in a philosophy series to science? In order to avoid one of the really bad habits of philosophers. Indeed, it's something I like to call the philosopher's fallacy. It's the reasoning error wherein philosophers will all too often take a question that's empirical, that is, which is a truth of the world that we ought to be able to learn by investigating the world, and instead posit an answer out of thin air because it agrees with a theory they want to be true. Now, here are two fancy Latin terms we often use in philosophy. A priori and a posteriori. The term a priori means knowable without experience. In other words, if a sentence is an a priori truth, if and only if I can know that it's true or false without having to see how the world is. I don't need sense experience to see, hear, taste, smell, or touch the world in order to know something is true or not. Consider the sentence, I have a brother or I don't. That is a priori. You don't need to know anything about my family to know whether it's true that I have a brother or don't, because whether I do or don't, the only two options, the sentence is true. It's a logical truth. Now, there are non-logical a priori claims as well. Consider some ethical claims. Take the sentence, it's morally wrong to stick a fork in a puppy for fun. That's something I should know to be true a priori. I don't have to run the experiment to know puppy fork sticking equals bad. Do not do. A sentence is a posteriori, on the other hand, if I do need to consult the world to know whether a sentence is true or not. Take the sentence, I have a brother. That's a posteriori. You do have to investigate the way the world is to know whether it's true. And it is. But you would need some observable evidence to support the claim. A posteriori claims are the property of science. That is what science does. It tells us how the universe is. Scientists come up with hypotheses, that is, possible ways the world could be, and then work to determine which of them are likely true, that is, which hypotheses most likely accurately describe how the world truly is. A priori claims, on the other hand, are the focus of philosophy. What philosophers do is determine what various sorts of a priori propositions mean, what presuppositions are required for them, and what ramifications they have. We then provide arguments for and against adopting them. Where philosophers run into trouble is when we encroach on science's turf. That is, philosophers can fall into the trap of assuming how the world must be because it would be helpful for our a priori arguments if the world were that way. A posteriori truths can restrict a priori ones. In other words, philosophers need to know science. We need to know how the world is in order to try to answer our questions as well. That's the reason for this discussion. Before we launch full out into a philosophical analysis of humor and laughter, we need to know what science tells us so we know how to frame our questions and what answers are immediately ruled out. So, let us consider the question, why do we laugh? There are several different ways that this question could be understood. One way is, what happens in the brain to trigger laughing behaviors? Another is, why do human beings develop the ability to laugh? Another is, what environmental factors make it more likely we will laugh? Another is, what social function is served by laughter? And yet another is, how did we come to be beings who laugh? Let's look at these one at a time. Lots of different stimuli can produce the same outcome, laughter. These different causes of laughter take different pathways through the brain, but the last few steps in the brain's motor region are all the same. whether it's laughing gas, tickling, or hearing a good one. The last few steps of the neurological explanation is the same, but not so with respect to the earlier steps. Tickling, for example, starts in the hypothalamus, deep in the old part of the brain. The hypothalamus is the part of the brain that we share with all sorts of other animals. It regulates hormones and takes care of all the involuntary actions we like to have without having to think about. Things like beating our heart, swallowing, and breathing. It also releases certain neurochemicals automatically when we perceive things in the environment. When we perceive a threat, we get a boost of adrenaline thanks to the hypothalamus in order to kick in the fight or flight reflex. This is actually the same part of the hypothalamus that's active when we're tickled. The brain considers tickling a form of attack, but when the expected harm doesn't appear, it signals the laughing reflex. Now, when you touch a part of your own body, the brain sends a signal to that part to expect contact. That's how you know you touched the right part. But this does not happen when someone else touches you. The brain processes it without the expectation. This difference is why you can't tickle yourself. So, the laughter from tickling starts in the deep brain, the old brain, the animal part of the brain. Laughter from humor, on the other hand, involves several parts of the higher brain. It's a complex interplay of many regions, but important among them are three. For verbal jokes, the right frontal lobe, just above the right eye, is triggered. This is the area that's involved in making plans, coming up with explanations, and self-control. It's the part that's involved with social inhibition, the part that keeps us from doing things we want to do, but we know we shouldn't. It's surmised that this is why we find things that are shocking, disgusting, or taboo to be funny. People who have damage to this part of the brain lose some or all of their sense of humor related to verbal jokes, but will still find slapstick funny. Also involved is the left superior frontal gyrus. These are the folds on the top front of the left side of the brain. It's responsible for self-awareness. One neurosurgeon who had implanted electrodes in a patient found that when he stimulated the region electrically, the patient would find something funny. It wasn't a random laugh, but rather the patient would describe how she would find a particular thing humorous. A little electrical stimulation, and she would smile. A lot of electrical stimulation, and she would have a hearty laugh about what she was thinking about. The third part involved is the anterior cingulate. This is the part of the brain that's involved in problem solving, error detection, emotional response, and motivation. It's the part that allows us to hold in mind contrasting possibilities and evaluate them. It tells your brain to reward or punish you based on the outcome of your choices. If you place a bet and lose, it tells your brain to send disappointment and frustration. If you win, it's the part that tells the brain to have you celebrate. It's also one part that's very sensitive to the presence of lead, which is why those who suffer from lead poisoning will often make poor decisions. So, laughter comes from the appropriate signals sent amongst a collection of parts of the brain. Those parts are affected by a number of environmental factors. This means that we can make someone more or less likely to laugh based upon the environment we put them in. Every comedian and comedy club owner knows that if people drink alcohol, they not only decrease their self-control, but they're also more likely to laugh. People under the effect of alcohol find things funnier. The reason for this is neurochemical. But there are other elements as well. A smaller room is more likely to get laughs from an audience. Rooms that are red will have better audiences for comedy than rooms that are blue. Jokes with ducks in them will get bigger laughs than those with other animals. Jokes that are 103 letters long will garner maximum chuckles. The funniest time to put in a joke? 6:03. The funniest day of the month? The 15th. Except, of course, in April. By the way, these are all real examples. Scott Weins discusses them in his book, Ha! The Science of Laughter. Because the brain processes humor according to certain mechanisms, we can figure out how to best trigger those mechanisms. We can do it through scientific testing in the lab, or, as comedians have been doing for centuries, we can test it in the field. So, when the various parts of the brain work together, what you get is a brain capable of getting jokes and making you laugh. But that ability has to develop over time. As such, humans laugh differently and at different things and at different moments in our lives. As the brain develops, it focuses on different things, on acquiring different abilities. Along the way, the brain is ripe for messing with. If we do something unexpected with that new function, the brain will cause us to explode with laughter. As we discussed in a previous lecture, from 6 months to 1 year, we establish object permanence. That is the ability to recognize that something out of sight is not gone, just somewhere else. Once this is a part of how we understand the world, we're able to get great pleasure from peekaboo. Before 6 months, nothing. After 2 years, yawn, boring. The brain has moved on. At 2, we've begun to make sense of language and the expected uses of objects. Tell a 2-year-old, go to your belly button and put your applesauce away, and she'll think you're George Carlin. Pretend to eat a banana without peeling it, you'll get laughs that would make any professional comic jealous. Preteens are at a cognitive stage where they're making sense of abstractions. Before 6, the brain cannot tell sarcasm from bona fide communication, cannot tell a lie from a joke. But from 6 through the teenage years, the sophistication has sufficiently arisen to appreciate what we normally consider to be standard jokes. We have the mastery of linguistic elements and the ability to anticipate how things should be. A good punchline will strike them as extremely funny. Think of all our standard clean jokes. What's green and goes slam, 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 slam? A 4-door pickle. What's purple and swims? Moby grape. Why did the orange go out with the prune? Because it couldn't find a date. The audience for these jokes are kids in this age group. It's then that we start to see joke books and comics become sought-after commodities. This is not an accident. At the tween stage, 10 to 12 years old, we see an uptick in inappropriate or toilet humor. The main task at this age is internalizing social rules. And so, anything that violates them is considered funny. Gross jokes, violent jokes, noises that resemble certain bodily functions. These are the sorts of humor that reign for this age group. This is markedly more so with males than females. In fact, it's been observed that many men fail to outgrow this stage, which some have taken to imply that developmental psychology simply does not apply to men. I remember that I was 10 years old when I came up with my first joke. I was in a car in North Baltimore when we passed a furniture store called Garin's. My grandmother explained to me that it was called that because the owner's sons were named Gary and Ron, and when he put the two names together, that's how he came up with the name for his store. I turned to my grandmother and said it was a good thing his sons weren't named Morty and Ron, because then he would have had to have called the store Morons. At 10 years old, the idea of a store being called something insulting was terribly funny. The teen years bring to an end the stages of rapid cognitive development. Sadly, so too, we end our peak laughter years. It's not just a sense of nostalgia for childhood, but actual empirical fact that we laugh much more often and much more heartily when we're kids. The older we get, the less we laugh. Indeed, adult laughter is quite different from childhood laughter. The 19th century French physician, Guillaume Duchesne, distinguished between two kinds of laughter, what we think of as authentic laughter and social laughter. We call the first one spontaneous, eruptive laughter, Duchesne laughter. We call the second social, polite, forced laughter, non-Duchesne laughter. Adults are much more likely to engage in non-Duchesne laughter than Duchesne laughter. For adults, laughter is not a reaction to something we find funny, but rather a social signal. It becomes what psychologist Robert Provine calls a social lubricant. He studies contagious behaviors. These include yawning, laughing, and the passing of gas. That's no joke. If you hear someone fart, you are more likely to feel the need yourself. It's a contagious behavior that Provine seriously studied. Would have loved to have seen the grant application for that one. In his time examining laughing behaviors, Provine noticed something expected and very unexpected in the results. The expected result is that laughter amongst adults is almost exclusively social behavior. we're almost 30 times more likely to laugh when we're with other people than we are alone. If laughing was a simple reflex, a bodily reaction to some set of external stimuli, then the setting should not matter, but it does. When we laugh, we almost always are with other people. So, we don't just laugh because we find something funny. Indeed, we usually don't find something funny when we laugh as adults. We laugh at particular, very regular points, but it would not be the points we would expect. If two adults are talking, it's more often that the speaker, not the listener, is the one who will laugh during the conversation. We laugh at our own words more often than we laugh at those of the person we're speaking with. And the laughter is not random. It serves as punctuation. We laugh most often at the end of our own sentences. We'll say something, and then when we're finished, we'll laugh about it. And the sentences we laugh about aren't jokes. We're not laughing a big old Duchenne belly laugh, but a sort of social laugh that signals a sort of self-deprecation. We see this when we chart who's most likely to laugh in this conversational way. It's much more likely to be the person of lower social standing. The more social power a person has, the more likely the listener will laugh at the powerful speaker's words. The less social power a person has, the more likely he or she will laugh at his or her own. We see this in American culture in terms of the breakdown of gendered conversational laughter. When women are listening to other women, they'll laugh about half the time. But if a woman is listening to a man speak, she will laugh almost three quarters of the time. And when the woman is speaking to a man, she will laugh at something she has said a whopping 88% of the time. Men, on the other hand, will laugh about 75% of the time when talking to another man, but only 66% of the time when talking to a woman. And the fewest laughs come from men listening to women. They only laugh a little less than 40% of the time at something the woman says. Now, one may be tempted to assign a perfectly biological explanation to this. But the fact is, we see similar phenomena when we take gender out of the picture and just look at the workplace. When workers are speaking to their bosses, they're most likely to laugh during the conversation. Bosses, listening, are the least likely to laugh during the conversation, although they're most likely to make what we would identify as a joke. There's a relationship between social power and the probability of one laughing during a conversation. And it's most likely the speaker who laughs at what's been said, not the listener. Adult laughter is not the laughter of kids. Kids laugh together, but for adults, the laughter is directional. It sends a social signal. This social laughter eases our ability to communicate with each other and establishes, or at least affirms, hierarchies. It's used as a social signal that I mean you no harm, that you're safe with me, that I am not a threat. Anthropologists and other scientists interested in the origin of human laughter take this as a clue about the possible evolutionary foundation of laughter. Why do humans laugh? Why is it that this strange behavior has developed? Evolutionarily, humor and laughter seem to be a bit of a puzzle. They're universal amongst humans, so surely they must have evolutionary origins. However, humor seems to be a terribly odd faculty to have been selected for by environmental factors. Laughter uses a lot of energy. Now, energy is the currency of biology. Organisms need energy for everything, and in nature, it's a sparse and valuable commodity. You only get it by eating, and food is not readily available. You need the energy for all your activities that keep you alive, and need a store in case you suddenly have to burn it through fleeing from a predator or some other potentially deadly circumstance. As such, energy is not to be wasted. But that seems to be exactly what laughter does. It uses a lot of energy and seems to give the organism nothing in return that would be valuable in terms of survival in brutal nature. Laughter and humor seem to be disadvantages that would have been evolutionarily stripped out of the species. Why would the opposite be the case? Now, There are two camps of evolutionary explanations for the development of our ability to laugh at funny things. One camp takes humor and laughter to be direct effects of evolution. That is to say, that laughter serves a functional purpose and funny people are better equipped for the world. The other camp says that humor and laughter are biologically based as a result of the evolutionary process that created humans, but only accidentally. There was a faculty that developed as a result of evolution, but it wasn't humor or laughter. But once this other faculty was established, it accidentally gave rise to humor and laughter. Humor and laughter are evolutionary free riders, a happy accident, what Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin referred to as a spandrel. Turns out we are not, as Aristotle once claimed, the only animals that laugh. There are different but similar sorts of verbalized behaviors in the other great apes. Chimps, for example, grunt and smile at each other. Gorillas and orangutans also seem to have physical expressions of humor that look a good bit like ours. One part of the camp that takes humor and laughter to be direct results of evolution point to this as a starting point. Now, what we share with other great apes is our sociability. We live in groups. Because there is safety in numbers, it's helpful for survival to have a clan looking out for each other. When someone in the group spots danger, signals are sent, putting everyone on high alert. High alert uses a lot of energy. The brain is very focused. The heart rate increases. We're ready to attack or flee. Muscles throughout the body are tensed. We only want to be in this state as long as it is absolutely necessary. To get fellow group members out of this state, we need another signal indicating that everything is safe. We're okay. There is no danger. Everyone, relax. This, it's surmised, is where the laughter comes from and why it's contagious. When one member of the group starts laughing, we hear it, relax, and start laughing too, so everyone else will hear it and relax. Laughter ends the needless use of energy of high alert. Think about how your body reacts when you laugh. You can't think of anything else. You can't be worried or angry. Laughter is a sort of physiological, psychological reset button. Maybe that's the whole point of it. Maybe it played a role for our ancient ancestors as such. Once we had the ability to laugh, we looked for other non-danger-based situations to cause it. So laughter developed naturally, and then we look for technologies, humor, to create it at will. There's an indirect version of this account, too, where the direct version gives an evolutionary account of the development of laughter and had humor develop as a result. This one reverses the cart and the horse. Maybe humor developed first. The idea is that we did develop signals for placing everyone on high alert. Making the right sort of signal could cause everyone to adopt the stance of hyper-awareness. Now, add a little bit of self-awareness to this ability. Consider this modern-day situation. You and a friend went to see a performance of a hypnotist, and the hypnotist left a psychological trigger in place after the show so that now, every time you clap your hands, your friend clucks like a chicken. What would you do with this ability? We all know full well what you would do. Some of you would make your friend cluck nonstop. Others, the more devious amongst you, would wait for the perfect moment, say his wedding, and you would wait for the absolutely perfect moment to clap. We're human, we do this sort of thing, and it would be hilarious. So, if you were a proto-human, and you knew that making a certain sound would cause everyone around you to act a certain unusual way, what would you, or at least someone amongst us, do? The first human joke on this account is crying wolf. It's one of us lying to the rest of us to see if he could get us to needlessly go on high alert. It's a game of manipulation. The joker knows the truth, and when he sees us manipulated, it tickles his fancy. When we hear his laughter, we realize we've been had and that there's no real danger, and we can relax. Now, a second direct account for the evolution of humor points out that natural selection, that is survival of the fittest, is only one of the two selection mechanisms. The other is sexual selection. Certain traits are selected for not because they aid in survival, but because they aid in finding a mate. Think of the male cardinal's bright red color. It does not help one to survive to be bright red. Indeed, it does the opposite, making you more obvious to your predators. But being bright red does help find a date on Friday night when you're a male cardinal. Maybe that's what entrenched humor is within the human species. If you look at singles ads in newspapers, it's much more often that men advertise having a good sense of humor, and much more often that women say they are looking for someone with a good sense of humor. Maybe the sense of humor is like the color of a cardinal. The final line is an indirect approach. The idea is that humor is an accidental evolutionary development. The human mind needs to do a lot of things at very fast speed. Having a powerful brain allows us to use tools to build things, to do lots and lots that aid in our survival. But thinking takes time, and when you're being chased by something that could eat you, time is not something you have. But our minds make mistakes, especially when we think fast. We need a brain within our brain that checks the work of the first brain at an even quicker pace. Having two brains in one takes even more energy than just having one big brain, which already takes a lot of energy. So we would need some sort of motivation to spend energy on the second brain. As such, when the second checker brain finds an error in the work of the original brain, it would need a reward. This reward would have to be good, something we like. A wave of pleasure is the brain's reward for the second brain's good work, which could end up saving our life. But once we get a taste of this reward, we want more. So we set up fake situations with errors embedded in them so that we can find them and get the reward. These are jokes. Jokes are just gaming the system that evolved along with a complex brain. Which, if any of these is the right answer, that's the hard thing about evolutionary biology, especially evolutionary psychology. We don't know. What we do know is that we laugh, and sometimes at jokes. Sometimes. We have some sense of how and why we laugh, but knowing only opens more questions. And given what we now know about the science of laughter, we now turn to philosophy. The old joke is that when you know less and less about more and more until you know nothing about everything, that's when you're doing science. When you learn more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing, that's when you're doing philosophy. So we are now turning from knowing nothing about everything concerning humor to knowing everything about nothing concerning humor.
Lecture 4, Truth and Humor.
Dimitri Martin.
Okay.
That would
Dimitri
be...
Dimitri Martin.
Very clever, really.
Food is here.
Oh, lunch.
You got the cashew chicken.
That's me.
Right. Kung Pao beef.
That's mine.
And Szechuan tofu.
Me.
Jacob.
Hey, how can you tell after 10 seconds that somebody's a vegetarian? Because after 10 seconds, they've told you three times.
What's the relationship between humor and truth? First glance, there isn't one. Jokes are just jokes. We don't believe that chickens really cross roads. We don't believe that an elephant was ever crossed with a rhino. We don't believe that the Pope and Charlie Sheen walked into a bar. At least not together. After a joke, if someone gets upset, we say, hey, I was only joking. In other words, you should not get upset because what I said is not something I believe or want you to believe. It was only a joke designed to get a laugh, not a statement designed to express a belief I contend is factual. We joke all the time about things we know are not the case and expect that our audience will also recognize that it's not the case. But on the other hand, some jokes are only funny because they're true. Indeed, it's their truth that makes them funny. Consider a caricature. A caricature is only funny if the exaggerated feature of the target really is something that catches attention. If you're looking at a caricature of Jimmy Durante, and his eyes are huge but his nose isn't, the caricature would fail. He had a big nose. That's a fact. So, for the caricature to be funny, it has to exaggerate the prominence of his proboscis. The representation of the true is needed for it to be funny. Similarly, for political humor to be funny, it needs to comically represent what's really happening in the world. For political humor to be funny, we have to recognize the actual events of the culture in the joke. George W. Bush is lampooned for mixing up words. Barack Obama is lampooned for being too smooth and cerebral in the way he spoke. If you were to make a Bush joke about Obama or an Obama joke about Bush, it wouldn't be funny. The joke has to have some connection to the real for it to work as a joke. At the same time, the joke may have a partisan perspective attached to it. It may be the case that what the joke uses are not facts per se, but partisan interpretations of the facts. As such, we have a perspectival truth. But for the joke to work as a joke, we have to understand how the character who delivers the joke really sees the political world. We don't have to agree with that perspective to find the joke amusing, but we do have to see how someone like the Joker would see the world in that way. Finally, there's observational humor. Jokes that come from seeing the world we all live in from a clever or unexpected point of view. What I think is the best observational joke ever, in fact, I believe it's one of the best jokes of the 20th century, is attributed to both George Carlin and Gallagher. I think both told it, and it's not clear with whom it originated. Why do we drive on a parkway and park on a driveway? From a technical standpoint, there is so much to love about that joke. In terms of its content and phrasing, it's incredibly tight. The elegance of it's amazing. The economy of language and the rhythm are superb. Add to that the symmetry in incongruity. Half the joke would be funny, right? Why do we park on a driveway? Drive and park are both indicators on cars with an automatic transmission. Park means the car does not go, and drive means it does go. Yet on a driveway, we don't put the car in drive, we put it in park. It's opposite. By itself, a really good observational joke. But it also includes the converse. We also drive on a parkway. On a parkway, we don't put the car in park, we put it in drive. There's the exact same incongruity in both directions, only mirror reversed. And before it's pointed out to you, you don't see it. It's not an obvious joke. It's not a cheap joke. But it works because it's so well formulated, because it's so well integrated structurally. But most of all, it works because it's absolutely true. The undeniable truth of the joke is what makes it so wonderful. So, jokes are both true and not true. They're not intended to be statements that convey new information about the world, but yet they're true. What is the relation between truth and humor? Now, we'll spend 8 lectures trying to set out a clear and complete definition of humor. So for that side, let's just start with an intuitive sense, according to which we know a joke when we hear one. But what of the other side? What is truth? That should be an easy question, right? We all took true and false quizzes in school, and while the problems might or might not have been difficult, it was never in doubt what was meant by true and false. So, what do we mean by truth? This is philosophy. Nothing is easy, especially that which at first glance seems easy. Philosophers have generated a sizable literature trying to understand the nature of truth. There are 4 primary positions on the matter: the correspondence view, the coherence view, the pragmatic view, and the subjectivist view. Let's work through these to see if any of them might make sense in terms of truth in jokes. The correspondence view is the common sense view of truth. Truth and falsity are properties of declarative sentences. Only declarative sentences can be true. Suppose you're in my class and I'm giving a quiz. Question 1, true or false, Abraham Lincoln. What's the answer? There isn't one, because Abraham Lincoln is neither true nor false. He was president, he was tall, he was assassinated. These are all properties that could and do belong to him, but true is not something a person could be. Only declarative sentences can be true. So, What makes a declarative sentence true? A declarative sentence says something about how the world is. The world either is that way or is not that way. Consider the sentence, Steve is wearing pants. This says something about how the world is. It might be that way or it might not. If the world is the way the sentence describes, if this is a world in which Steve is, in fact, wearing pants, then the sentence that accurately describes the world is deemed true. If the sentence is false, and this is a world in which Steve is not wearing pants, then it will also be a world in which the complaint department at the Great Courses will be incredibly busy. So, if a sentence is true, if what it says about the world is actually the case in the world, if the content of the sentence corresponds to the world, then the sentence is true. The sentence, Steve is wearing pants, is true if Steve is, in fact, wearing pants. How in the world could anyone object to that? Well, correspondence theory requires us to know whether there is a correspondence between the content of a sentence, something mental, something in our heads, and the real world, something out there. This is a view with a long history from St. Thomas Aquinas through John Locke to contemporary thinkers like D.M. Armstrong. This account of truth requires us to know how the real world really is. Philosophers are going to have problems with that for two reasons. First, there are truths that are not descriptive, but normative. That is, think of true ethical statements. The sentence, "It is morally wrong to stick a fork in a puppy," is true, even though it does not describe any real situation in the world, hopefully. Much of philosophy, therefore, deals with true sentences whose truth is not covered by this view. Secondly, it requires us to have access to how things really are. I know what I see and hear, but those sense perceptions are in my mind. How do I get outside my mind to the world itself in order to know what is really real? Can we ever get to the actual real world itself? So, a weaker theory of truth was developed to allay these concerns. We call it coherence theory, and it's been advocated by thinkers from the 19th century idealist Friedrich Hegel to the 20th century logician Willard Van Orman Quine. The central notion is that while we believe lots of things, they're not individual, unattached atoms of belief. Rather, they're integrated webs of belief. Our beliefs are interconnected. And when we believe one thing, it affects what else we believe. Now, if I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in shooting John F. Kennedy, then I don't believe in conspiracy theories according to which he acted with others. I believe that President Kennedy was shot. I believe Oswald held the gun at least one time in his life. Our beliefs form an interconnected web. A sentence is true if I integrate it into my web of belief and cannot be true if I cannot coherently integrate it. If my web disallows a sentence, then I think that sentence is false. If the web forces me to accept it, then I think it's true. Sentences are not true or false on their own, but only as a part of a belief structure. Again, philosophers have raised objections. Of course we did. For example, we do sometimes believe contradictory things, sometimes knowingly, sometimes not being aware of the logical conflict. Contradictions have to be false. That's what it is to be a contradiction. But how do I know which contradictory belief has to be the one to go? It could be either one. Then the notion of truth seems so weak that truth loses its specialness. And without truth being an important status, it hardly seems to be what we mean by truth. A third approach comes to us from American philosophers like Charles Saunders Peirce, William James, and John Dewey, and we call it the pragmatic view, according to which a sentence is true if it does what it's supposed to do. Language is a human tool. The point of a tool is to do a job. Language is like a Swiss Army knife, being able to do lots of different jobs. A sentence is true if whatever job it's supposed to be able to do, it does. If a sentence is supposed to explain something and it offers a good explanation, then it's true. If a sentence is meant to convey a mental image and it does, then it's true. Pragmatism is a deeply anti-metaphysical position. It does not appeal to an underlying reality that's disclosed, but rather in the pragmatist's own terms to cash value, to what an utterance is for, what it accomplishes. One concern with the pragmatic approach is that we use language for all sorts of things. Description of what we believe the world to be like may be the most common usage, but it's far from the only one. I may also, for example, use language to deceive. If I'm effective in getting you to believe something I do not, then my language use has been successful. But that would label the lie true for being a lie. This would make it true and false, something that ought to worry us. The final position is the subjectivist view. On this account, everyone has his or her own truth. What is true for you is for you to decide what is true for you. There needs to be no external or philosophical justification. You decide that which you say will believe, and if you say a given sentence is true, then it's true for you. So, to recap, we have four main philosophical accounts of truth. Correspondence theory is the most metaphysically dependent. It says there is a real world that is one way, and a sentence is true if it describes that way. Coherence theory does away with a connection to reality and concentrates on our internal web of interconnected beliefs. A sentence is true if we weave it into a web in a way that allows it to cohere with all the other sentences we're committed to the truth of. The pragmatic view holds sentences to be tools designed to accomplish a desired task, and a true sentence is one that does what we need it to do. Finally, the subjective view allows that truth is a privileged status we afford to some, but not all sentences, and we are free to designate whatever sentences we choose. We simply designate it as true, and it thereby becomes true for me. When we talk about truth and humor, do any of these work? Let's think about the joke in the intro. How can you tell in 10 seconds whether someone is a vegetarian? In 10 seconds, any vegetarian would have told you three times already. The joke does seem funny because, in some sense, it is true. But in what sense do we say it's true? Correspondence theory? This joke is true if it accurately describes reality. Does every vegetarian alert you to the fact that he or she does not eat meat every 3.3 seconds? It may seem like it, but no. It's a humorous exaggeration. In order for an exaggeration to work, there must actually be something to exaggerate. In this sense, there does seem to be some correspondence to the world. But that correlation is not one of accurate description, and accuracy in description is what truth is for the correspondence theorist. Whatever truth and humor ends up being, there must be something correspondence-like in the account, but it's not actual correspondence. Coherence theory? Surely there's something like this active as well. The very architecture of most jokes is a setup that leads you to construct a joke world according to certain pre-established beliefs, and then a punchline that does not fit into the web you build, forcing you to reconstruct your knowledge structure to make it fit. Right? Think of the old chestnut. Two guys walk into a bar. A third one sees it and ducks. How does this joke work? You hear the setup. Two guys walk into a bar, and you form a belief about a joke world. There's a drinking establishment, and there are two guys, and those guys enter the drinking establishment. Then you hear the punchline. The third guy sees it and ducks, and realize that it makes no sense with the belief structure you've built. You believe the punchline, that the third guy saw a bar and ducked under it, and have to rework what you understand the information in the setup to have been telling you. Now, you believe that the joke world has in it a pole, that two guys did not see the pole and bonked their heads on it, but the third guy saw the pole and was able to avoid it. You did the mental work to create a coherent belief structure, and the point of the joke is to force you to reconstruct it with an unexpected punchline. The problem is that each joke comes with its own temporary belief structure, and it's never clear what's in it and what's not, and when you build a temporary web of beliefs, you do so knowing it's temporary. You don't really commit to weaving the information in the joke into your actual web of beliefs. Maybe we think a joke is true if there's a way to map the temporary belief structure of the joke world onto the more permanent belief structure of the real world. That is, there's a correspondence of coherence. This would need to be an account that has to be fully worked out, and it's not clear what sort of correspondence it would be, since they would not perfectly mirror each other. Pragmatism? Well, jokes are clearly utterances with a goal. You tell jokes to get a laugh. You want to amuse your audience. Some sentences achieve the goal. Mission accomplished. Does that make those sentences true? No. Not all jokes are truth jokes. Some jokes we know to be false. Jack Benny was not really a cheapskate. Phyllis Diller was not a horrible cook. Rodney Dangerfield's wife was not always cheating on him. We get that these are characters, fictions, and still find the jokes funny. And even when we're dealing with truth jokes, like the vegetarian joke in the intro, the relationship is reversed. It's not that the sentiment is true because it's funny, but funny because it's true. It's not true because it accomplishes its task, but rather is able to accomplish its task because it's true. The truth precedes the task. But in the end, there does seem to be some way in which a full accounting of truth and humor involves accomplishing a task. Finally, subjectivism. This one we can disregard completely. If truth were subjective, then we would each have our own truths, and we could never be sure that our truth in any way resembles other people's truths. But in order for a joke to work, there has to be a reasonable belief that what I hold to be true is like what you hold to be true. If not, communication itself, much less jokes that hinge on particular background beliefs, would not be possible. The vegetarian joke requires that we all believe that vegetarians are vocal about their lifestyle choice. All jokes require filling in the joke world from a set of presumed common background beliefs. If we cannot presume this commonality, there's no reason to suppose we could ever joke. So, there are hints here in the four traditional views of truth, but none of them really answers the question for us. But this shouldn't surprise us too much, because jokes are not normal speech. Normal speech, what linguists call bona fide communication, is the use of speech to insert in your mind a belief that pre-exists in mine. I believe something, I want you to believe it, so I say something to you to cause the idea to pop in your head so you'll believe it too. But that's not what we do with a joke. Jokes are not factual communication, but artistic communication. Joke tellers are like storytellers. Jokes are kind of like very, very short stories. Truth in literature has long been a question that's interested philosophers. If we want to learn about the human condition, we're sent to great literature and drama, from Homer to Shakespeare to Updike to Hooks. The great authors expose what it is to be human. But if we can learn something about being human from reading literature, then there must be truth in fiction. But fiction is not true. That's what makes it fiction. So, how should we understand truth in fiction? Philosophers have tried a number of accounts. Two big ones are fictional realism and contextualism. Fictional realism is the view that what works of fiction do is create their own realities. The writer makes a world. Fictional truth is correspondence to the fictional world. The correspondence here does not run into the problem of regular correspondence theory. Recall that the problem was a metaphysical one. Correspondence theory requires us to know how the real world really is, and we don't have direct access to the real world. Since we cannot know how the real world really is, we cannot know which sentences accurately describe it. But in the case of fictional realism, we can know this. It's a created world, and the author creates it as he or she sees fit. As such, the author has a God's eye point of view and can tell the reader. Consider the movie The Wizard of Oz. Were Dorothy and the Scarecrow really friends? Well, for the fictional realist, the answer is no. Why? Because the whole thing was a dream. There was not really a Scarecrow for Dorothy to be friends with. There was a farmhand who resembled the Scarecrow, but he was a fictional real person in fictional real Kansas. Does this sense of fictional truth give us what we want? No. Because when we want to hold that a joke is funny because it's true, we mean true in the real world, not in the joke world. Yes, the joke is true in the joke world, but that's trivial. We mean that it tells us something about this world. Not just about joke vegetarians, but about real vegetarians. Now, contextualism, on the other hand, is the view that what the author does is to create a context in which the reader possesses a limited number of facts about the fictional world, and truth is a function of coherence within that limited created context. You only know what you're told, and everything you're told is true within the context of the telling. So, let's think about the Dorothy and Scarecrow example again. Now, it is true that Dorothy and the Scarecrow were friends. It is true in the context of Dorothy in Oz. It's not true in terms of Dorothy in Kansas. We have what Avner Ziv called local logic. There is no all-encompassing way of making sense of the world, but in fiction or in jokes, we may have to use means that make sense in that context, but which we would reject outside of that context. We provisionally or conventionally assert the truth and way of determining the truth, but do so with complete acceptance that this is only to hold good within that context. Think of the film Inception. The plot is that the characters can enter dream worlds contained within dream worlds. Each new dream world works differently with different basic truths. Truth is fully contextual to the specific dream, and when one moves between them, it takes an effort to figure out or refigure out the truths of that world. But this again doesn't help us make sense of truth jokes. The point is not that the truth is local to the specific joke world. The joke tells us something about this world. So maybe we need to look someplace other than fiction for a model of truth that gets us to the real world. When we think about truth in the real world, what we think about is science. Maybe there's some approach to truth in science that would work for truth in jokes. A view about scientific truth that came popular among philosophers of science in the 1980s is what's called the semantic view of theories. Before this account, the assumption among scientists and philosophers was that scientific theories were sets of sentences. Newton's theory was composed of the three laws of motion and the law of universal gravitation. Darwin's theory was composed of the law of inheritance, the law of random mutation, the law of natural selection, and the law of sexual selection. Every theory could be axiomatized, that is, broken down into its basic statements. Some philosophers thought that we could go one by one through these axioms, see which ones were true, or at least well supported by the evidence, and then say something about the truth of the theory as a whole. Other philosophers argued that we could never test individual axioms, but could only test the entire group together. Theories stand or fall as a collection of interdependent sentences, but either way, theories could be set out as sets of axiomatic sentences, which could then be determined to be true or false. But then the semantic view of theories came along, and held that scientific theories were not sets of sentences at all. Rather, they were sets of models. What a theory does is create a simplified model of the system it's trying to explain. A model is not a sentence. It's a representation. Think of a model fire engine you might build as a child. The model isn't itself a fire engine. It's a representation of a fire engine. The models you built when you were 5 were not as good as the ones you built when you were 12. As an older child, the models became more intricate. They had more features that real fire engines possess. The models were better because they were more faithful representations. The semantic view of theories says that scientific theories are like model fire engines. They're representations. Some of the representations might be models similar to the fire engine example. But students of chemistry will often use balls and sticks to build models of molecules. The balls represent atoms and the sticks represent bonds. Theoretical physicists will build theoretical models that use algebraic terms to represent parts of physical systems. Meteorologists and climate scientists build computer models that can run simulations of scenarios involving the Earth's weather or climate.